Well, hello again.
Hello.
That video was very powerful, wasn't it? Really good. You know, several years ago, I had a privilege of traveling to Warsaw, Poland to attend a Sabbath Keepers conference. And it was something that was organized by a group of people that I had visited in Lisbon, Portugal, a couple of years earlier. It was connected with the work that I was doing through Legacy Institute, and not something that the United Church of God was involved with. Anyway, this small group had about 350 people in Lisbon. They had five congregations, and the Sabbath-keeping church organized in 1931, 3 years before the Radio Church of God. And the doctrines were very, very similar, very, very close. Anyway, I had made plans to travel to Poland. Leon Sexton initially was invited, but he couldn't go, so I got to go in his place. So I bought my tickets. And for some reason, I was not able to book the lodging online. And I tried and tried and tried, and I couldn't do it. So I had to go on faith that I'd have a place to stay when I got there. Is that something you would do? Now, there I was, traveling to a strange country, not able to speak the language, and I did buy a Polish-English dictionary. But it really didn't help much because all the letters were run together with no vowels. So I couldn't even pronounce the words anyway. And anyway, I caught the plane and I flew to Frankfurt, Germany. That was okay. That was nice. But then I caught this small plane from Frankfurt to Warsaw. And how small was the plane? Well, my carry bag for my laptop computer was too big for the overhead compartments. Okay, so I had to put it in with the luggage below the plane. I was actually more worried about that than I was about my lodging reservations. And we landed in Warsaw, and wouldn't you know, at least I wouldn't have expected it necessarily, but it looked just like the pictures. Eastern Europe. All these government buildings, government apartments built by the Soviets when they occupied Poland. They had that gray look everywhere. The only real interesting buildings were the ones that were built before they got there. Anyway, I got off the plane and walked out of the airport. Hear all these soldiers with machine guns. This is a little different than what you're used to. I'd seen it before, but this was even more so. And all these guys came running over to me, offering taxi rides. And, you know, they didn't have uniforms or anything, so you didn't know if they had a taxi cab or if they were just picking up people and taking them out someplace and mugging them. You didn't have a clue. But this man, I picked this one man and told him where I wanted to go. I showed him the address, and he said he knew where it was. And we started driving, and I had no idea where we were going. Never been in that part of the world at all. So we get to the hotel, and he pulls up in front, and they have these glass doors. You can see right into the lobby. There are five men standing there talking in the lobby. I know two of them. So that was very comforting. I go inside and say hello. These were the men that I had met in Lisbon. And one of them said, "Oh, if you don't have a room to stay, why don't you can share a room with me." So, voila. Problem was solved. Amazing. Yeah, Warsaw was a very interesting place. nothing's quite as moving as walking around the city and seeing all the war memorials that are there and the train station that is a memorial that you go to where so many Jews were taken to the death camps. To be in that spot, standing there, it's very moving. Well, in any case, I'd love to tell you that I always have that same confident faith no matter what happens, but it wouldn't be true. You know, when the pressure is on, you get in trying situations, it's easy to get a little panicky and wonder, well, how long, O Lord, will it be before you save me? You know, so far God has always come through, albeit what seemed like right down to the wire, and sometimes past the wire. Over the years, I've often wondered why this is the case. And I've often thought to myself, you know, Father, why don't you just help me a little sooner? Why do you wait until the very last minute? And even beyond the last minute, why do you do that? Now, why do you wait so long before you deliver me out of this trouble? Well, it's taken 40 years, but I finally have some answers to that question. Now, what is it that God wants most from you and from me? I could just as easily ask, why are you here? And maybe get the same answer. Now, some people might say something like this. They might say, well, God wants me to build holy, righteous character. That's why I'm here. Others might say something like, well, he wants me to learn to be a king and a priest. Something like that. Well, those ideas, they sound really good. And we've heard them many times that they're ideas you'll have difficulty proving from the Scriptures. Now, over time, we gradually begin to understand what God is doing. That's why I guess it takes a lifetime. But you begin to understand what God is doing on this planet. And when that starts to happen, the answers just seem to leap off the pages of the Bible. Let's see if you agree. Please turn to James 1. James 1, and I'm going to read two verses. I'm not telling you what they are yet because I don't want you to beat me there and read it before I do. James 1, verses 2 and 3. My brethren, James 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. You know, there's a reason James gave us this advice. And it's not just that you're learning patience. You know, it's not just that he's expecting you to have patience. Rather, it's about having patience in waiting on God. That's the patience you're learning. It's about learning to wait on God. It's about learning to trust Him. And once you begin to realize that, the fog begins to clear a little bit, and it's more easily understood what God is up to. We also understand why we have so many personal trials that take us to the critical stage of needing His help. Now, God expects us to have faith. We need confidence, believing confidence that He's going to take care of us and our needs. Now, I remember years ago when I was working at the headquarters of Worldwide Church of God in Pasadena, they had put in when they created the budget for that year, I forget what year it was, they created this budget and they had put in a 3% cost of living increase in the budget. And the treasurer thought, well, we can't afford that. So he went to Herbert Armstrong and he said, I don't think we can afford this. What was the result? He came out and everyone got an 8% cost of living increase. AWA had been through this so many times with God that it was easy for him to step out on faith, because he always saw the deliverance. He had that confidence. Jesus asked an interesting question during his earthly ministry, and I'm going to read this from the New Living Translation. This is in Luke 18, verses 6 through 8. Luke 18, verse 6 through 8. Then the Lord said, "Learn a lesson from this unjust judge." You know, he just told them the story about the widow that kept going to the unjust judge. He kept pestering him. Finally, he said, you know, he ruled in her favor because he didn't want to be bothered. So Jesus said, "Learn a lesson from this unjust judge. Even he rendered a just decision in the end. So don't you think God will surely give justice to his chosen people who cry out to him day and night? Will he keep putting them off? I tell you, he will grant justice to them quickly. But when the Son of Man returns, how many will he find on the earth who have faith?" Interesting question. Will he find faith? When he returns, will he find that you have faith? Do you even know what faith really is? Let's turn to the faith chapter, Hebrews 11, and find out. Hebrews 11, verse 1. "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." Now, neither the King James or the New King James really seem to give a satisfying answer here. It's a little fuzzy. It's just not clear. So I'm going to go to the New Living Translation and read how they render it. Hebrews 11, verse 1 from the New Living Translation. "Faith is the confidence that what we hope for will actually happen. It gives us assurance about things we cannot see." Interesting. I like that. Faith is the confidence that what we hope for will actually happen. Faith gives us assurance about things we cannot see. Now that seems pretty clear. But having that kind of faithful confidence, having that kind of assurance about things we cannot see, well, that doesn't sound like most of us, does it? It doesn't sound like most of us most of the time. Now, if this is the definition of faith, why don't we see more of it? Now, I want to connect this passage I just read with another scripture you might not expect, one that we often read as we approach the Passover. This is in 1 Corinthians 11. 1 Corinthians 11. And we'll begin in verse 27. 1 Corinthians 11, 27. "Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep." I was trying to decide if I was going to read any more, but I think I'll just stop right there. That last verse that I read, that's pretty powerful. I'll read it again. That's why this, I'm reading it from the New Living Translation. In fact, let me just read I'll read the whole passage here from the New Living, and you'll see that. I think it makes it clear. "Anyone who eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Master irreverently is like part of the crowd that jeered and spit on him at his death. Is that the kind of remembrance you want to be part of? Examine your motives. Test your heart. Come to this meal in holy awe. If you give no thought, or worse, don't care about the broken body of the Master when you eat and drink, you're running the risk of serious consequences. That's why so many of you, even now, are listless and sick, and others have gone to an early grave. That's why so many of you are, listless and sick, and others have gone to an early grave. Now that has to cut to the heart, because we all are aware that the great number of God's people are not well. Many have gone to an early grave, haven't they? Do you appreciate what Paul is saying? He's pointing out the folly of anyone who'd have such a shameful disregard for the brutal death that Christ had to suffer. Remember him? He's the one who died in our place. He's the one whose sacrifice we accepted. So Paul's talking about not really comprehending that. That's hard to even imagine. How is it possible for Christians who have accepted the sacrifice of Christ not to comprehend that? Now perhaps you think I've pulled this old classic bait and switch, because I started talking about one thing and now I'm talking about this. I started talking about faith and now I'm talking about the Passover. I assure you it wasn't bait and switch. It goes to the very core of why you're here. In fact, I'll ask that question again. It's a rhetorical question. Why are you here? When the Bible tells us about people of God having faith, these are more than just interesting stories. Now, they look like that, but these are examples of how they lived. They're for us. In fact, I'll just read that. You can write it down, look it up later. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, it says this: now, all these things happened to them, it's talking about ancient Israel, as examples. And they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Again, why are you here? Is it enough just to show up, listen to a message, and then you're covered? Now maybe you come regularly, or maybe you just come irregularly. Is that enough? Or does God really expect you to live a life of faith? Now, if we have faith, we should live like we have it. And the Bible's full of examples of people who did. How did they live? I'm going to cover a few stories here. The first one I'm going to go back to is in Exodus 14. Exodus chapter 14. Well, the setting is that God has performed all these wonderful miracles. The people are leaving Egypt. They're excited. They're happy. And then they see a little cloud of smoke off in the distance coming toward them. Chapter 14, verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Now, you can't blame them for feeling this way. They're looking behind them. They see Pharaoh coming, the army's coming. And they know he's hacked off. They know if he gets to them, a lot of them are going to be killed. Even after all the miracles that God performed, taking him out of Egypt, the reality of seeing that army coming is very frightening to them. They don't have the faith. They just don't have the faith that they need. Verse 13. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid." I can hear them now saying, "Oh, that's easy for you to say." "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which He will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever." It was hard for them to believe because you're talking about one of the most advanced armies in the world. Their chariots were famous. "The Lord will fight for you and you shall hold your peace." And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward." They have this picture in your mind's eye. They see the army. They want to stop going forward. They just want to quit. Give up right there. God's telling them, don't quit. Keep going. "But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them, so I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots, and his horsemen." Now, to most people, I'm not talking about the Church of God, but most people that read this, well, this is an interesting story. But the actual event was very, very real. Again, the Egyptian army was after them, and Pharaoh was angry. But they had a good reason to be afraid. But God uses this experience to try to get them to trust Him. Of course, they never quite did. They were continually fearful of the trials that came their way, no matter how many times God delivered them. Okay, here's another interesting story in Daniel. The book of Daniel, chapter 6. Daniel 6, verse 1. Because this is after Babylon has fallen. The Medes and the Persians now control Babylon. 6, verse 1. "So it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss." So that's how he organized it. Verse 3. "Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because of an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm." So he's going to make him like number two. Not one of three governors, but the guy leading under him. So naturally, some jealousy arose. "So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him." So Daniel's this guy of incredible integrity. Well, maybe that was why Darius wanted to make him the guy under him. It's because that's what Daniel was like. But they were jealous. They said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So the governors and satraps thronged together before the king and said thus to him. Well, they went on and they hatched this plot. Now, it's amazing. Their jealousy to envy, got them to devise this evil plot against Daniel. It's because they wanted his authority. They wanted his power. So they devised this plan, and got Darius to pass a law that you couldn't worship any other god during this short period. The law could not be changed. And they thought for sure, well, this is going to sink Daniel. He'll be killed because of this, because he's so faithful to his God. So when they show up and they tell Darius, oh, look, there's Daniel. He's worshiping another god. You have to kill him. But what was Darius' response? Verse 14. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself. They used him like a fool, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. So he did everything, he tried every way he could to figure a way out of this for Daniel, and he couldn't. The law of the Medes and Persians could not be changed. So then they came back and they reminded the king that he had to go forward. He's been approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So the king gave command that they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of the lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. So against his heart's desire, he couldn't change it. But he had hope. A small hope, but he had hope. Verse 18. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. Also his sleep went from him. So he wrestled the entire night, distraught over what was happening. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. He didn't really believe that Daniel would survive. But he cried out and he said, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O Lord, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him, and also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. Now the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. And Daniel had wonderful, wonderful faith. Now what an encouraging example of faith and deliverance. This is just an interesting story. It wasn't a story to King Darius. It wasn't a story to Daniel. He was living it. The lions were hungry, and they were very real. And how about an example of Abraham in his darkest, what might be his darkest hour, Genesis 22. Genesis 22, verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. Then he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall show you. I'm sure Abraham never expected that. Now this was going to be a very severe trial that was going to last for many days. And Abraham had no idea exactly what would happen. Of course he had hope, but he did not know. This was going to be a serious trial of Abraham's faith. Verse 3, so Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. So it's already been 3 days. This has to be continually on his mind. And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and the lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. So Isaac gets to carry the wood. And he took the fire in his hand and the knife, and the two of them went together. Verse 7, but Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, said, my father. He said, here I am, my son. Then he said, look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. So the two of them went together. Do you think maybe those words stuck in his throat a little bit, knowing that he was about to go up and have to offer his son? Now, I can't even imagine the stress that Abraham was under. Yet his faith in God was very strong, as he would soon prove beyond all doubt. Verse 9. And they came to a place which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. By this time, of course, Isaac has it figured out. But apparently he's got faith as well. He's pretty big at this point. He's not some little tiny kid. He's a little bigger. And Abraham stretched out his hand, took a knife to slay his son. And, you know, just that instant when he's ready to do it, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. First then he looks up and he sees a ram and they have the sacrifice. That's always about faith, isn't it? It always comes down to faith. And that's why faith and belief are so important to salvation. One more story here about faith. This is in the New Testament in Matthew 14. Matthew 14 and verse 25. In fact, let's back up a little bit. Verse 23. And when he sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. So Jesus stayed by himself. The disciples got in a boat, went out on the sea, and the water was rough. Verse 25. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it is a ghost. And they cried out for fear. Well, you understand why? You can't do that. You can't walk on water. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So he said, come. And Peter had come down out of the boat. He walked on the water to go toward Jesus, to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me!" And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Why did you doubt? Now, do you see yourself in this story? We all want to believe God, and we're willing to step out on faith to do that. Yet, it's a little unnerving when you find yourself doing the impossible. You can't walk on water. When we see what is happening around us, it's easy to begin to doubt that God will help us personally. You know He helps people. You know He delivers people. That's not the problem. He's helped others. We know that. We just don't have enough faith that He will help us when we're facing the trial like those Israelites in the Red Sea and Pharaoh's coming after them. It's a little hard to have faith when you're being lowered into a den of lions. That's a pretty serious trial. Now, it's not enough for us to read these stories, and God knows that. That's why He constantly takes us down to the wire with trials. That's why He does it. We need first-hand experience. You need that to have living faith become real and for you to really understand it. You need that constant deliverance for you to begin to have that kind of faith. That's why we're constantly bombarded with trials. Now, it's a little bit like being a parent. You can read about it, read all the books you want. You can talk to your friends who have children, and you know, they'll share their stories with you. Yet being a parent doesn't become real. You don't really understand it until you have the experience for yourself. That's when it becomes real. Hebrews 10. Hebrews 10 and verse 32. Hebrews 10, 32. "But recall the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings. Partly while you were made a spectacle, both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul." You know, it's not enough to believe that God is able to save you. If that's all you've got nothing. That is not faith. If that's how you think, you're not exercising faith. You're not living by faith. And just knowing that God is able. What was that passage in Hebrews 11? 1 again? Faith is the confidence that what we hope for will actually happen. Faith gives us assurance about things we cannot see. We also just read that the just shall live by faith. Well, who's the just? That's you. That's you. That's supposed to be you. It's supposed to be me. So I ask again, do you believe you are justified because you have accepted the sacrifice of Christ to pay for your sins? Are you living by faith? Now, of course, living by faith is not an easy thing to do. Yet that's what God tells us He expects from us. Living by faith is a bit like walking on the water. It's something that seems unreal, almost ethereal. You know, in the past, when things weren't going very well, there were some pretty severe trials that we had to face. And people said, well, how are you doing? I would tell them, well, the reality of living by faith is not nearly as much fun as the theory. Sounds like a great idea, but actually doing it, that's not nearly as much fun. You think that's what Daniel was thinking? Is he's being lowered into the den? This isn't theory. This is real. You know, I knew that God expected me to live by faith, but it was difficult sometimes. There were times when it was really frightening, very scary. And of course, at that time, I was a little bit less certain about what God was doing. Now, I was always troubled by the trials that just continually seemed to just pound down on you, down on me. Now, at times, it made me think that God was punishing me. And for a while, I would joke with people that He was punishing me because I was so mean to my sister when we were little. It was a payback. Maybe I'll tell you about that later. I don't know. Maybe I won't. Now, I knew that wasn't the reason. But I endured impatiently, always wanting and waiting for God to finally intervene. And He always did. He always did. It would be difficult to explain all the miracles that Anne and I have seen even just the last couple of years. And I can't say that I rejoice when trials come our way. But there's a certain level of peace that's there in dealing with them. It's like that old joke where a young man goes to someone very wise and he asks him, how do you make good decisions? And the man says, making good decisions comes from experience. Then he said, experience comes from making bad decisions. Well, experience has been a good teacher. You know, the last 40 years, as I say, I have gone through many trials, and I have a little more peace of mind now than I did at the beginning of my spiritual journey. There's a certain confidence there in God's deliverance. And, you know, really, it's the same thing we all have to deal with. We are all learning to live by faith. We are all learning to trust God. That's what so much of what happens to us is about. You know, just we're learning to trust God just like all those who have gone through these things before us. You know, are any of us exactly where we need to be in trusting God and having faith and living by faith? Well, no. We're not there yet. Life just seems to be a constant struggle, a constant trial. And things are likely to get a lot worse. Things are going to get worse in the future. We know it. Yet I know what needs to be done. And so do you. Now, I can't speak for you. But now when people ask me how I'm doing, particularly when I'm going through a trial, I just tell them, I'm walking on water.